and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Memorial Day weekend with reports that Trump's Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is slow-walking requests from the Senate Intelligence Committee for financial records and data of transactions between Trump associates and the Russians that FinCEN, the U.S. Treasury Division, has collected. James Henry, an investigative economist and lawyer who has written widely on offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking, who is a co-founder of DCReport.org and author of Blood Bankers, joins us to discuss how important the assets and capabilities of the Treasury Department are in investigating the layers of shell companies and offshore accounts that criminals, oligarchs, and money launderers use to disguise the sources of ill-gotten gains and the beneficiaries of secret transactions. Then we'll examine the role that Facebook could play in uncovering who is behind the fake news that was injected into the U.S. election and more recently the British, Dutch, French, and now the German elections. Jonathan Taplin, the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California and author of the new book, Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy, joins us to discuss how these powerful new monopolies have amassed and monetized personal data while protected by safe harbor laws from responsibility for complicity in the dissemination of fake news, jihadist messaging, and criminal activity. Then finally, we'll look into America's diminishing role on the world stage with the leadership deficit from a president who may have made smart real estate deals but has so little knowledge of foreign affairs and how government works that instead of being the focus of flattery and adoring attention that he craves, he finds himself more and more as the dumbest guy in the room. Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon and is the author of Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals, joins us to discuss a president out of his depth and the reckless endangerment of the United States. And joining us on this Memorial Day weekend is James Henry, an investigative economist and lawyer who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. He is a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale, and a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network and co-founder of DCReport.org with David K. Johnson. And his latest book is Blood Bankers. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Got to be with you.
Thanks, James. And last week, House Democrats asked Deutsche Bank to hand over information concerning possible ties between accounts relating to President Trump and the Russians. And they're on the these are Democrats on the House Financial Services Committee. And apparently, Donald Trump owes something like $340 million in unpaid loans to Deutsche Bank. And the letter asks for information involving the 2011 mirror trading scandal in which $10 billion was laundered out of Russia and for which Deutsche Bank agreed to pay a $425 million fine to settle with the New York State investigation into this scheme. So Deutsche Bank's already been shown to be pretty dirty. So what's happening with the $340 million that Trump owes them?
Well, I think, you know, they've had a hard time getting it paid. Deutsche Bank was sued by Trump in 2008. He claimed that the Deutsche Bank was, which is his one creditor back then, had caused the financial crisis, and he pleaded force majeure in terms of a $40 million personal loan on a Chicago project. But Deutsche Bank has been his largest single creditor. All the other creditors that he has are private firms that are lending, you know, first mortgages against some of his more valuable properties like Trump Tower. But Deutsche Bank is also interesting because of this Russian case. And indeed, just on Wednesday last week, they announced a settlement pending apparently with the Justice Department of the money laundering charges. They'd already been subject to a $650 million fine for this Russian money laundering that went on from 2011 to 2015. The fine was from the New York State authorities and the Brits. So, you know, there still is outstanding prosecution, but it looks like the Justice Department under Sessions is, you know, going to be kind to Deutsche Bank. There's a lot more to know about Deutsche Bank and its operations in Russia. The previous chairman who moved on to become chairman of the Bank of Cyprus, Joseph Ackerman, you know, was very close to Putin. He was there from 2003 on and, you know, until 2012, and, you know, was was basically the guy who reduced the compliance procedures at the Deutsche Bank, and New York State found that he was personally responsible for a lot of the misbehavior that went on there. But basically, they were laundering an incredible amount of money through New York and Cyprus and other Deutsche Bank offices around the globe through this procedure of back-to-back trades. But anyway, the Trump relationship with Deutsche Bank is very peculiar. I mean, essentially, this is the only global bank that would lend to Trump after 2000, given the fact that he'd had, depending on how you count, between four and six bankruptcies during the 1990s, costing major banks at least $9 billion of write-offs. So no major bank would lend to him except Deutsche Bank. So it's a very interesting relationship, and I understand the Congress's desire to, you know, to pursue this.
Well, but the other avenue that Congress is trying to pursue, at least through the Senate Intelligence Committee, according to the top Democrat, Senator Mark Warner, is they have been trying to get information via FinCEN, which is the U.S. Treasury Division that looks into global financial transactions. They apparently are a very, very sophisticated group that really do know what's going on as much as anybody does about all of this shadow banking, offshore accounts, etc., dummy shell companies, all of those, that sort of mirrors and mirrors within mirrors that shelter who the actual owners are of these various properties and transactions and hidden funds.
That's right. I mean, the Obama administration had taken steps to increase the regulations that apply to foreign investors in the United States. And one of the things they did was with respect to real estate, they started to require investors from countries like Russia and China that were flight capitals pouring into, you know, say, New York real estate or the kinds of transactions that the Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort was engaged in with some of his Ukrainian partners, you know, where they were using anonymous shell companies to invest secretly in real estate. Well, FinCEN was beginning to crack down on that. In October, they issued some temporary regulations. And now we're concerned that the new Secretary of the Treasury, Mnuchin, is going to roll those regulations back and, you know, require less reporting on these foreign transactions. So it's kind of this financial secrecy is really a big part of, you know, the kind of the Trump-Russia connection network when it comes to these shady business deals that he and his colleagues have been engaged in. You know, and I've been focusing really on this kind of criminal network aspect of Trump's of the Trump-Russia relationship as opposed to the collusion story, which, you know, as much as subject of the investigations going on, you know, by the FBI and the Justice Department and the and much of the Senate work. But I think there's another whole story here, which, you know, has been the subject of several very good European documentaries that are, you know, just coming out this month or you know, just last week. There's a new one by ZDF, the German public television network, devoted a whole hour to it. Documentary called Trump and Organized Crime, and you know, I think they were making real progress in terms of investigating some of the projects that he was you know, he was involved with that were basically financed with the help of Russian or former Soviet Union GARCs and kleptocrats and in some cases convicted mobsters, basically using his projects as, you know, very sort of projects that they would not have to be very discriminating about to invest in. So,
right. Plus, they get to live in New York, and
a lot of these people living in the Trump properties. Right. You know, we've just identified a loan from a Putin-chaired bank, Russian bank, to a Canadian business guy who turned around and entered into a $15 million licensing deal with Trump to build the largest tower in Canada. There's questions about Trump properties in Florida, Panama, Phoenix, right midtown Manhattan, the Trump Soho. All of these projects had a lot of dodgy investments involved, and that's what these European documentaries, but so far no U.S. documentaries have gone after.
And again, I'm speaking with James Henry, an investigative economist and lawyer who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. He's a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale, a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, and co-founder of DCReports.org with David K. Johnson. And his latest book is Blood Bankers. But just back to the FinCEN, the U.S. Treasury Division that apparently is extremely sophisticated in terms of its ability to track dark money around the world, and it's been used as a weapon, in effect. In many ways, it's the sort of new nuclear weapon. If you basically get cut off from the SWIFT banking system, as a lot of Putin's cronies have been, it's pretty bad news. And apparently, again, the Senate Intelligence Committee has been trying to get documentation out of FinCEN, and Mnuchin, the new Treasury Secretary, is slow walking it. So what do you think can be done there?
I think that there are a number of things. First of all, we do have an increasing concern on the part of European allies, the United States, that all this activity has been going on. And so they have their own kinds of FinCEN equivalents where they are able to monitor the ownership and transactions of some of these networks. I think FinCEN is basically responsive to congressional pressure, and so to some extent, if there is a uproar about the extension of secrecy to protect these crooks on the part of the American people, we can complain about it. But the intelligence agencies themselves have also got their own access to these, this kind of information, and the FBI has probably some of the best access as well. So there are other alternative sources of data about financial transactions. It's just that you'd like to see the U.S. Treasury moving toward more transparency and not less, because it's really bad for the encouragement of the kinds of kleptocratic institutions that we're seeing, proliferate now in the Middle East and former Soviet Union countries and also China. Kleptocracy is on the march.
So let's turn then to your belief, James Henry, that in many ways Trump's prior business dealings with the Russians and others, which is all pretty much out there, most of it is, at least obviously you're doing a lot of digging to find more information, but even I understand with the information that you have so far, you think you could make a stronger case against him than what the intelligence communities are looking into in terms of possible collusion with the Russians over the election.
The issue with respect to his projects is that some of them look very much like a combination of money laundering and fraud on investors, where investors were simply not informed or told up front before they invested in these projects or in the condos that they were buying, about who the dodgy business partners that Trump was doing business with, even though he knew who they were. Now, money laundering statutes of limitation go back, 10 years, so you could potentially bring in some of the transactions that happened in 2007 and 2008. There's also, a number of deals that were done, like the purchase of his house in Palm Beach by this Russian oligarch who suddenly showed up and had $95 million to spend on a house that had cost Trump $41 million 4 years earlier. And conveniently kind of got him off the hook on his $40 million Deutsche Bank debt, because that profit flowed right to his pocket. You know, that's a transaction that nobody really understands. There are a bunch of transactions like that that we're beginning to understand. And one that just showed up in this Dutch documentary 2 weeks ago was involved a kleptocrat from Kazakhstan, a former mayor of Almaty, who fled to Switzerland. He ended up having a company, joint ventures in the Netherlands with this Russian mob-owned company, Bayrock. And the companies in the Netherlands were set up by Rudy Giuliani's law firm. So, you know, it seems like every week now we're beginning to understand more and more about the Manafort connections with this oligarch, Deripaska. He's getting $10 million a year to lobby on behalf of Deripaska, this aluminum czar. Who the United States wouldn't let in because of his organized crime connections. There are, just an explosion of material on the kind of criminal network side of the story that I wish the United States Congress would take a look at. They seem to be focusing mostly on, the tapes and the classified information, which is, the subject of the collusion story. This is, in a way, a much simpler story, and it may well be that, Trump can't be indicted for this stuff by a grand jury. I mean, he's the president of the United States. He has to be impeached, but certainly any congressional investigation could take a look at some of what we're finding on the criminal side.
So just in terms of the obvious stuff, that it's just such a coincidence that Trump Tower is full of Russian gangsters and kleptocrats. My understanding is that you can't really buy into a lot of buildings in New York. You've got to go through the co-op board, and you got to be approved. And it's pretty clear that there was no such restrictions on Trump's part. In fact, it was an open invitation. Bring your money, no matter where you're from, as long as your money's good.
No, you had people like Golubchik, who was running a gambling ring out of the 51st floor of Trump Tower. You had protégés of Mogilevich, who's the boss of Moscow, owning multiple apartments. One guy was a former Soviet Air Force veteran who, during the Vietnam War was helping to shoot down U.S. planes over Vietnam, and David Bogatin, and he served time for felonies, and he had five apartments in the Trump Tower. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It's just... there's just the parade of dodgy relationships here. And I think, at the very least, you'd say this president wasn't very discriminating in terms of who he did business with. And as Cervantes says, you are who you walk with. And he's walking with, basically a bunch of, villains and garks and kleptocrats as his best friends. And just in the last few days, he places a call to Duterte, this murderous president in the Philippines, and basically lauds him on his, on his drug policy. I mean, the fellow just has really got low bar for who he does business with.
Well, just in closing, my understanding, I just talked to somebody the other day who had stayed in Trump Tower for a while, who subletted one of these condos, and said everything was incredibly cheap. The fixtures were cheap and falling apart, and the kitchens were incredibly small. So he, again, it's as though.
I think we could convict him of bad taste. I mean, I wouldn't want to live there. The reason that this place attracted so many dubious people was because, there was no condo board to kind of look on over the shoulder and say, what are you really doing for a living? And, so they could basically take all comers as long as they could pay the bills. The irony is that a lot of the people who are fleeing places like Russia and China with their, hard-earned billions, basically looking for a place that has the rule of law, that has democracy, that has respect for, kind of the independence of the judiciary. These are kind of the hard-fought institutions that the United States has. And it's ironic indeed that these are the kind of institutions that are wide open to the world's mobsters.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry. He's an investigative economist and lawyer who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. He's a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale, and a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, and co-founder of DCReport.org with David K. Johnston. His latest book is Blood Bankers. We can take a brief station break and be back looking into how we can take on the new monopolies, Facebook, Google, and Amazon.
Bermuda in the Bahamas, Front Street, Hamilton. They do more than growing bananas. They got a tax dodge going on. Offshore banking business.
International crime.
Offshore banking business.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And on this Memorial Day weekend, we're joined by Jonathan Taplin, the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communication management and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. His latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Taplin.
Good to be here, Ian.
And unfortunately, lately, it's very hard to keep up with the chaos in the White House and the daily media explosions of Donald Trump. But nevertheless, there's a lot of rather mendacious legislation underway in the House and Senate. Perhaps even Trump's follies are a shield behind which Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan are enacting an extremely reactionary agenda. And one of the many pieces of mendacity, of course, is getting rid of net neutrality. So just paint us the broad landscape of where we stand in terms of, the, on the one hand, these massive monopolies like Google and Facebook that you've written about in your new book, Move Fast and Break Things, the power that they have, the dominance that they have, and at the same time, the last bit of the public commons in a media landscape that's totally dominated by corporations, it seems to be about to be rolled up.
Well, it seems to me that the FCC new commissioner who's appointed by Trump could probably by mandate eliminate net neutrality. They wouldn't even have to go through the Congress. If he has, the Republicans have 3 votes on the commission, the Democrats only have 2. So what that would mean would be the following, that every ISP could then charge different rates for different speeds and also charge different rates for people to be part of the what is known as the data bundle. That is the amount of data you can use that's unrestricted on your mobile phone or your iPad or some other thing that's using the cellular network. So essentially what that would do would be that the startups would be incredibly disadvantaged over the big players like Google and Facebook, which have billions of dollars to spend to be part of the bundle and be part of the high-speed internet. And to me, that would be a disaster.
Well, in a way, though, so much of what's happening seems to be regressive. For example, we're going back to coal and fossil fuels instead of moving forward with alternative energies. Not that the state of California is not charting its own course here. So it does seem that the country that invented the internet is about to close off this massive opportunity for education and entertainment, which will be universal broadband. So is there a way around this? I mean, what can citizens do? Because people are, as you recall, last time when there was a threat to get rid of net neutrality, there was an explosion of communications thrown at the FCC, which swayed them. But this guy that they've got now seems like an ideologue, and I don't think he cares.
I think he is an ideologue, and I think he's, I mean, this is the classic notion of regulatory capture, where the big companies, whether it's AT&T, Verizon, Google, or Facebook, have essentially captured the FCC, and already, as you notice, they've changed the privacy rules so that they can sell your search history to anybody. And so there's no reason to believe that they aren't going to go through with this change to net neutrality. Now, that isn't to say that California couldn't change, create its own law that might override that. And then we'd have one of these classic fights between the federal government and the state, which I've seen before, and obviously we may see over climate change and California's auto emissions laws and other things like that. But that might be something that'd be worth exploring. Secondly, I think the other big question that's being pushed is the notion of privacy. You know, there are some people who are trying to push through a bill that would mean that you'd have to opt in to allow people to take your data, and so that would be a kind of big sea change, which of course Google and Facebook are fighting furiously. But here again, California could pass laws for privacy laws that would make it possible for you to not have everything that you've done be subject to being sold to third parties.
So, again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Tapler, the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. And his latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And, of course, we always think of Google with this motto, do no evil, and the idea that these apparently, or at least allegedly, benign companies like Google and Facebook, the more and more, and you seem to be one of the few people that are prepared to take on this massive monopoly, and Google has, of course, I think twice the market capitalization of ExxonMobil. It's an enormously powerful company. But in the current politics with this Russian investigation, there are fingerprints from Facebook enabling the fake news through Cambridge Analytica and Stephen Bannon and the Trump campaign, etc. And we don't know the extent to which that fake news was Russian or originated from Russian intelligence. What is the situation now when we have these inquiries in the House and Senate going on, and apparently, according to a recent article in the Washington Post, a couple of researchers at Oxford University are looking into the extent to which Facebook could tell us how Russia interfered in our elections, but apparently they won't. They have the ability to basically give us the whole history of who planted fake news.
Well, look, Facebook just shut down about 75,000 fake accounts. Now, it knows who put up those accounts. It knows the IP address of everyone put up those accounts. And these were accounts essentially meant to influence elections. And those were just before the French and British elections. We don't know how many fake accounts were created just for the American elections. So the question is, obviously, fake news, Facebook and Google's YouTube know a lot more about who's posting these fake stories than they're letting on. Of course, their whole business model is based on getting as much content as possible. And for them, it doesn't really matter whether it's true or not. It's just a matter of having as many clicks as possible. So I think, you know, these companies need to be a lot more transparent with their data. And they have to be transparent to both researchers, and they have to be transparent to the press. You know, Tim Berners-Lee, who was the founder of the World Wide Web, when he was talking about the fake news explosion, he said, well, the Google ad system trained the people who were posting fake news and, quite frankly, making a lot of money out of their bedrooms in Macedonia or wherever. Google ad system trained them just like you train a dog. In a way, it gave them more money for the things that were more clickable. So they learned that untruth was more clickable than truth. So the fake news is a real business. Somebody is making money off it. And the reason they're making money is that Google allows anybody to have an AdSense account and make money off these clicks to their fake news accounts.
So what is then the reason why Google keeps claiming to have no responsibility for what, in terms of what publishers normally would be responsible for with libel, you know, even child pornography, child predation, all kinds of excuses are being made. I mean, eventually they do take down really toxic sites, and there was a recent cold-blooded murder of an African-American man on video, as we all know. But in general, explain to our listeners what this safe harbor business is about. You know, Google is making all this money, one of the richest companies on the planet, if not the richest company on the planet, and yet it acts like the piano player in the whorehouse. Oh, I'm not responsible.
Right. No, that's exactly the truth. So here's the story. You know, when the almost 6 weeks before Google went public, unfortunately, the Clinton administration had created a law called the Safe Harbor Law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And essentially what it did was it said that no individual could sue YouTube or Facebook or Google for content that was residing on their services. So what that did was give them a total pass. But in order to do that, they had to pretend that they had no control over the content that was on their services. But the problem is they do have control. And quite frankly, on YouTube, they decided that pornography was a bridge too far because they're an advertising-based business and advertisers wouldn't let that. So they have very good artificial intelligence that can screen out all the porn. When someone tries to upload something with a bare breast in it, it puts it into a separate queue, and then a human looks at it and decides whether it's National Geographic or porn. And if it's porn, it goes in the dumpster. So that same tool could be applied to all sorts of things. It could be applied to ISIS beheading videos or people killing each other on Facebook. But they choose not to do that. Now, exactly why that is, why porn is off limits, but ISIS beheading videos are not, is something that only maybe Larry Page at Google could tell us. But that is the reality of the situation today.
And how Google extending this safe harbor law that the Clintons allowed in to the rest of the world? Are there any countries around the world that are resisting Google?
Yeah, safe? There are. I was just in Australia, and the Australians have a different law. They only give safe harbor to ISPs, so that would be like Comcast or Verizon or something like that, someone who's actually providing the pipe, because the notion being that you can't know what's coming through your pipe. But now they're getting a lot of pressure in Australia from Google and Facebook to extend that safe harbor to Google and Facebook. And some people in Australia, like Turnbull, want to do that, and some people, like the artists and the publishers, are resisting that. So it's an interesting battle being played out, and quite frankly, it's playing out in the EU as well. I mean, the EU, especially Great Britain, not just after the Manchester thing, but before for the Westminster incident, realized that the homegrown jihadists are being trained off of YouTube, and they would like to put more controls on it. But the only way to do that would be to remove Safe Harbor and make Google responsible for what's on YouTube, or Facebook responsible for what's on Facebook.
So is there then any legislative path here? We started out the conversation by pointing out how the Trump people are giving away the store to the big cable companies, and essentially by getting rid of net neutrality, they will end up cableizing the internet. And we all know how terrible our cable services are and how little choice we have with the stuff that they foist on us, and how poor the general service is. I think the national average for broadband in the United States is 9 megabytes per second, whereas in South Korea, Japan, even France and other countries, they have a gigabyte, 1,000 megabytes,
right.
And that's standard, and
right.
it comes at about a quarter of the cost. So we're all getting screwed. So what's happening in the legislative landscape to
Well, there's two things that could be done. The first would be to get rid of the safe harbor. That is, make these people responsible for what's on their service. So that would be the first thing. And the second thing is some kind of privacy legislation. The EU has put forth a GDPR, which is a general data privacy regulation, which is going to go into effect in May of next year. It's being fought like crazy by Facebook and Google, but if it does go through, the individual person will be able to have control of what data is shared and what data is not shared with these third parties. So those two things alone would make a gigantic difference. I mean, because I've been doing a book speaking tour, I've had people come up to me and just talk about this privacy issue, which, you know, there seems to be a whole generation who thinks that privacy is an old trope. But 2 weeks ago in New York, a neurobiologist came up to me and said, look, I just want you to know that we've done some very deep research that the accelerometer in an iPhone or a Google phone can detect Parkinson's disease. And just the same way it can tell you how many steps you took this week and save that into an account, it could save into the thing, the tremors from your hand, Parkinson's. Well, who's going to have that data? That data isn't under HIPAA. That isn't controlled. And who could sell that data to your health insurance company? Who could sell it to your employer? So to me, I think we're heading down a very slippery slope here. And if you think about it, the more data you're turning over, and after all, that's the business these companies are in. They're not in the content business. They're in the data business. The more you do that, the more now Google is going to add your credit card history to all the data it already has. They'll know much more about you than you know.
Right. And they'll make money out of you, and you don't get anything out of it.
So, exactly.
Well, Jonathan Taplin, I thank you very much for joining us here. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Taplin, who's the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communication management and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. His latest book is Move Fast and Break Things: How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Trump now finds himself as the dumbest guy in the room. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us on this Memorial Day weekend is Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And it is extraordinary that the pillar, the centerpiece of Donald Trump's and Rex Tillerson's foreign policy is to make a deal with Russia, which certainly doesn't look like it's ever going to happen. Or if it does, that would be a big surprise at a time when it's pretty clear that Russia really isn't. You know, its GDP is, I think, somewhere between Italy and Canada. There's a whole other world out there, with China in particular being a major player. What, to your mind, explains this peculiar affection connection with Russia that is obviously being investigated? But I think it came very clear when Trump had the Russian foreign minister and the top spy in their top spy in Washington in the Oval Office, kicking out the American press and allowing the Russian press in. And we know subsequently that he gave away the story, told them secret information, put in jeopardy Allied spying assets in very dangerous places in cities held by the Islamic State, and also absolutely trashed the head of the FBI, who he just fired. So do you have an explanation for this?
I think, Ian, that the eminence, as it were, the importance of Russia is certainly a hangover from the Cold War period. This is the other legendary superpower, after all, and with all those missiles and nuclear warheads. And as Henry Kissinger used to say, what's a few multiply independently targeted warheads among friends? These were the two eminent powers of that era. And I think regardless of the decline of a post-Soviet Russia, regardless of what you rightly point out as its sort of second and in some respects even third-rate status as a power, it's going to command that respect on both sides of the aisle in Washington and in the media. As for Trump's affection and connection here, I think that does obviously trace back to his dealings with Russia, and that I think will be the result of and the product of the investigations that are going on, that multiple connections financially and a bailing out of Trump interests here and there, both in the United States and abroad, and a general sense that to celebrate the Russians and to work out some kind of détente was also a matter of stark contrast with the Obama administration, with the Democrats. I'm going to be very different in foreign policy as well as in domestic affairs, and so I think all of those factors are working. As for giving away the store, I think this emphasizes the central characteristic of Donald Trump's foreign policy, which is that it reflects the pathology of the man. It reflects the perversity of his personality. He wants very much to be impressive. He wants to be loved. He wants to be approved of by his immediate audience. He's done that even in some defiance of his Russian attitudes and policies with the NATO ministers, and he even had the absolute courage and boldness to speak of the Russian threat. I take it that's a sop to being liked and loved by the Baltic states and by Poland and the Czechs and so on. Donald Trump is as we always knew, and I think it'll be the story, the epitaph of this administration, all about Donald Trump. One must not look for or worry about too much, I think, very much consistency in foreign policy. There is no Trump doctrine, but Trump. And I think that explains trying very much to impress these Russians, I can't imagine that any kind of sophisticated intelligence operation which really had a Manchurian candidate in the Oval Office in the old traditional sense would have been that heavy-handed or that overt. On the contrary, there would have been much more effort to cover these things up and to mask them.
Well, my sense is that Donald Trump, as much as he wants to be loved, and he spends all his time vilifying people and insulting them, at the same time, he wants to be loved. He particularly wants to be loved by Hollywood and the celebrity world, and it really burns him up that they don't like him, and that his friend, so-called friend, the quarterback with the New England Patriots, didn't show up at the White House. Apparently, that really...
Tom Brady.
Yeah, really hurt him. But my understanding is that what he's not enjoying this job at all, because he likes, in real estate, he's the big guy in the room and makes makes all the big promises and the loudest voice and all that stuff in a flim-flam world. But in the Oval Office, he's the dumbest guy in the room.
Absolutely.
Everybody knows. Everybody.
I think the wear and tear is showing on the face.
Right.
As well. And, Rick Perlstein, whom I do not always agree with in terms of his histories of the Republican Party, had a very nice little piece in The Baffler recently talking about how much he had ceased to really worry about Donald Trump's threat to the Republic or the constitutional order on the premise that you just expressed, which is that he's the dumbest guy in the room. This is a shrewd politician only in some respects, and in others he's quite incompetent and quite blundering. But you're absolutely right. He expects, I think, from his business career, you cut the deal and the money changes hands and all your old enemies love you again. I think he does expect to insult and to offend and to still be adored. And that, of course, lies in his personality, not in any kind of logic.
But in not knowing anything and being in a job that he has no training and background in and apparently not a great deal of interest in, yet he's got this incredibly important position. So the question is, does he listen to the people that actually know something that he doesn't know, or does he listen to these kind of courtiers that flatter him, like Kellyanne Conway and Bannon and company? And we know that he has a propensity to believe people like Alex Jones and Breitbart News. So that...
I think the frightening thing is that both are true. I think he is listening to some extent to people who know. But after all, I think that's the academy of the overrated. I mean, we came to regard Mattis and McMaster and some of the others as the adults in the room, the competent people, when in fact they really are second and third raters from the fringe of the military bureaucracy and elsewhere. But he is to some extent listening to those people when he's totally without any perspective and sometimes without any immediate interest in the subject at hand. But he's also obviously still listening to what I would call the lunatic fringe around him, who I think must be chastened by now. They can't be too sure of what his reactions will be or will not be. I think there is obviously still an agenda there with Bannon and with the ultra-right, but there must be also some hesitation with what he could do or would do. And again, I'm back to the personality factor. I don't think this is a man who will willfully or deliberately take great risks with his reputation, with the affection that he wants, with the reelection that he covets, and the approval of the American voter, and certainly even approval internationally, which we saw in this trip. I mean, he's perfectly willing to contradict himself completely in order to please the audience of the moment. And I think that may be not necessarily sanity or logic or strategic interest, but that may be in itself our greatest safeguard against some kind of catastrophic blunder.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. So in terms of a Trump foreign policy, as this last week indicated, the trip to Saudi Arabia first and then Israel and then the Vatican and then the NATO summit, again, there it does feel like he really doesn't know anything and he's influenced by the last person he talks to. But there's clearly some effort underway to – there is a kind of Sunni-Israel alliance underway with the between the military government in Egypt, the Saudi royals, and the Israelis. The glue that binds that is animus towards Iran. It's pretty extraordinary that you meet with these Saudi despots at the same and castigate Iran at the same time it has an election that that re-elects a so-called moderate leader. And because in Saudi Arabia, the last thing that that greedy royal family would ever allow would be an election, and that's not even, you know, in the cards and never will be. So there was a major irony there. And so just is there possible that as this guy's presidency sort of spins further out of control and his ratings go down, they're now down around 37% as they sink even lower, because I don't think he can control his impulses and tweet out crazy stuff. Do you foresee any kind of confrontation with Iran as a sort of wag the dog scenario?
That's what I worry about most. I think that there is a genuine pulling back, a withdrawal in a sense. By default, he has no concerted purpose, no coherent plan of any kind for any part of the world. It's very much improvisation. I think that leaves, in geopolitical terms, that leaves the initiative, the agenda, and to some extent the control of events in the hands of the regional actors without great power intervention. Not even the Russians are going to be able to control what you just pointed out in the Middle East, this Sunni alliance against the Shia Iran power. I think the United States will find itself more and more passively reacting to these things. Now, that's not a factor for safety in international politics. It certainly could be. We could certainly be drawn into something that has gone on much too long and much too dangerously. But I don't think that Donald Trump will be a major actor in world politics as he sees himself or as he promised to be. I think, on the contrary, that the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Israelis, this sort of unholy alliance by anybody's religion, unholy in the Middle East, will be a driving force. One can only hope, Ian, that the innate conservatism, the innate selfishness and greed, as you pointed out, of both the Arab and the Israeli side of things, will be some restraint. But I think the United States has not only surrendered prestige and honor in the world with Donald Trump. We've certainly surrendered a great deal of influence. And I think there's a feeling in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and certainly a feeling in Riyadh and elsewhere, that they can go on without the Americans. And I think that's a fear, obviously, too, in Tehran. This could be, under different circumstances with that election, a really pivotal moment in relations between Iran and the West. I don't think it will be, because, as I said, it will. We've ceded control of the agenda to the reactionaries, and that's not going to be a force for peace.
And of course, our reactionaries will embolden and strengthen the reactionaries in Iran, who just got repudiated in this election.
Oh yes, So yeah, they're another unholy alliance. But right. I don't worry about Donald Trump being being some kind of Hitlerian revolutionary leader in the world. I think, on the contrary, his very narcissism and pathology will restrain him somewhat. And he's going to be very, very busy at home. This investigation will continue to unwind. Mueller is like a dog with a bone. This is going to be long and detailed and very arduous. And the opportunities for Donald Trump to shoot himself in the foot or some more strategic area are just many, and they will continue to grow.
So just in the last couple of minutes, then, turning to the U.S. and the direction that Donald Trump is taking it in, while he may be floundering, he has enabled a very reactionary agenda to be pushed through by Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, and it's pretty breathtaking how much they are trying to turn back the clock at every level. But when you look at the budget, and which is the sort of the DNA of their intentions and the future they want to take, the direction they want to take the country in, it's just in the briefest possible terms, it's all about America standing for death and power, projecting death and power at the expense of life and health.
I think it's overlooked in all of the sensation about Donald Trump and the perversity of his behavior, that this is the single most reactionary period in modern American politics. The rollback of regulatory protections, the budget that they've submitted, what the Congress is doing quietly as well as conspicuously, all of that is an ultra right regression in American political life. And I think it emphasizes that the real villains here may not be Steve Bannon and Donald Trump in terms of power, but the old traditional power of the Senate and the House, where Ryan and McConnell, two rather unspeakably terrible leaders in terms of the functioning of democracy, have been in control of this agenda. And that's going to get worse until, of course, things are reversed. It puts a premium in on 2018. It puts a premium on the Democrats getting past their own petty divisions and recapturing both the House and the Senate so decisively that in some cases, in the important cases, they can be immune to a presidential veto. That's going to take a lot of hard work and a lot of turnaround on the progressive side of things. So you're quite right. This has been an incredibly regressive interval, and making up for it, compensating for it, recovering from it in the near future is going to be a very, very hard climb.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.